Welcome everyone. We are back for another episode of Talking Split. I am Rob Coulter, the Coach Development Officer at Basketball Victoria. With me I have Mike Zeppel, who is the High Performance Coach for Metro. How are you, Mike?
Roberto, I am well, mate. How are you?
Very well. You haven't been tapped on the shoulder to take over the country role as well yet?
Metro slash country at the moment, Robbie. We do have a third chair in here, just waiting for the next person to join us on the pod. We're taking applications for a co-potter.
That would be fantastic if we can. People are probably sick of listening to us at this stage. We do need to tee up another guest. We have a couple in the works at the moment.
Hopefully
happen in the next couple of weeks.
Exciting. So that'll be really good.
We do have a couple of episodes coming up on trials, team selections. I think team selection might have actually been our first.
The debut last year.
I think we strategically did it roughly 2 weeks after trials from memory. So we might try and get this one in before trials this time, so we can actually help out some of the coaches.
Nearly 12 months of the pod, Robbie. That's extraordinary that we have not been taken off the air yet.
Every episode that finishes, we check each other and just go, hey, are we still employed at this place? We're good. Let's just roll on with this and see where we end up from there. So, as per usual, big thanks to everyone that does like, share, retweet the pod as well. It is appreciated, especially those that have left reviews and rankings for us on iTunes and Spotify, where you can get the podcast.
You've got a couple of apologies to make to start off, Robbie.
It doesn't sound like something
I
do.
You tipped Eltham and Southern Penn to win last week and both got trumped. So I just apologise to them for your poor selection or putting the mock on them.
Not an apology as such. I'm a little bit... it's probably an apology, in fairness.
Robbie tips you run in the other direction.
I wouldn't put a great deal of faith in what I predict. There's a reason I don't gamble on sports, in particular basketball,
for that.
Other than the fact we're not allowed to. I have no idea, is the simple fact of it. I can't predict anything.
So I agree.
So thanks to all our podcast listeners. Don't listen to me when I talk. Obviously, go down the mic path if you get a chance.
Weekend number two of those championship series this weekend. So I'm sure Eltham and Southern Penn will be right there Saturday night.
I am still a chance of being right in the Southern Penn summary one. I did think I predicted that 2-1.
I was waiting. I kind of butted you up. This sounds like my NBA finals debacle that went on about 3 months ago.
Cleveland in seven wasn't your best work.
No, it was not. And your VJBL boys finished up for the year, Robbie?
They got a little gift from the boys. It was very nice of them. They... nice Flight Centre voucher, which was good. So they may have been trying to get me out of the country, as it turns out. But I very much appreciate that gift. But also the book from the Kids of the End was fantastic.
What book?
Not an actual book. It was a put together book. Sorry, Mike. I can pass that one on for you to read if you like. But it was a book with pictures of all the kids. They've all written a letter just saying thanks and what they enjoyed over the course of the season. There was one kid that said, hey, I really liked your 1-on-1, 2v2, 3v3, 4v4 drills. So effectively scrimmage.
Yep.
And thinks I should do them with the next team I coach. So the career advice for him was fantastic.
Well done. A small-sided game fan, is that what he is?
He's a big fan of the small-sided games, mainly when he's on offense, I found. There was one kid that actually told me that it was a pleasure for me to coach him. Which was greatly appreciated. So I will miss the...
How did you feel about coaching him this year?
He got a defensive player. He was pretty good. It was a pleasure for me to coach him, it turns out. He was just a very aware kid. So, it has wound up for this year. So now the VJBL cannot send me to Bellarine every second or third week. My life will be not dictated to by a fixture, but we'll certainly miss coaching those kids. They were good fun.
Awesome. I'm sure they are in good stead for the future.
We'll find out in the next couple of years how I've gone this year, I would suggest. But on the back of last week's episode where we talked about how to create the perfect player.
Athlete, yep.
Got some good feedback via email with people that sort of said, hey, well, we heard that. It was great to see a number of players email in as well and say that they listen to the podcast and that's what they're going to bring to their trials coming up fairly soon, which good luck to them. Hopefully it works out. But we thought we should probably double down on this and go, what makes the perfect coach?
Prototypical coach, those qualities and values that we see in our line of work that our good coaches really have.
Yep. We are not the prototypes, as it is. As I said, my season's ended and I can't predict anything.
We are podcasters, that's what we are.
Just podcasters. But again, I mean, probably the first thing off the bat is there is no such thing as the perfect coach.
Right, and we say perfect very loosely.
Yep.
Everything, I think these really good coaches, everything's always a work in progress. I think that's the start of it. Like, you if you ever think that you're anywhere, you probably stop getting anywhere. So all these great coaches, and we'll rattle off some names this afternoon, but all of these coaches would look at themselves very much as works in progress.
So there is one coach we haven't mentioned, of course, Justin Shuler. Were we using him as a prototype, or are we sort of saying, look, maybe he's got some work to do as well?
Major work to do across all five of these categories, mate. I wish he was here for us to tell him that.
Due to check in with him fairly soon.
He might get a call one of these weeks. Yeah. He might get a call, an impromptu. I think the start of it all is that I think coaching is an interesting word. Coaching can be taken a few different ways. I prefer to use the word teacher.
Yep.
And I think I was told really early on, like, coaching, anybody can coach a basketball game, like roll through the subs, get the timeouts, conduct the halftime, do whatever you got to do, warm up. But how many people can actually teach the game? And I think there's a real distinction in being able to coach the game and teach the game. And then how you teach the game, do your athletes actually understand what you're talking about? So I think I like to use the term teaching as opposed to coaching. And I do think that the environment, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that you create has to be a teaching and learning environment, the same way that a classroom is a teaching and learning environment. So I listened to a podcast through the week. They were talking with the head coach of Belmont University, who's done an unbelievable job over the last decades, about his culture and program that he's built. And he spoke about that he doesn't see himself any different to an instructor on campus teaching math. Like, what's the difference between us? You're an instructor of math, I'm an instructor of basketball. These are higher education students that we're trying to help get through university and be a citizen of the world. So I think that's a really, really sharp way of looking at it.
Absolutely is. And I mean, realistically, most people, the first interaction they have with people other than their parents and other kids will be their teachers. So as they start to come through their formative years, you know, prep or foundation, I think it's now called. It's changed a little bit since I went to primary school. Pentridge it might have been called when I went through school. But they're probably the first people that they do interact with a lot of kids. So it is important as a coach that we can come in and we can have a lot of the similar traits to a teacher that is really going to set these players up for the rest of their lives, we hope.
Oh, yeah. And if you think about your maths teacher at school...
I pity that person.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing. They would not speak to their athletes, their math students, the way that some coaches would speak to their pupils or students. So I think that, and that plays into the whole teaching and learning, like what kind of environment do you want to create as a teacher of, we're talking about basketball, so that your athletes are able to learn in that environment. And then in the same way as a teacher looks at their classroom, want to set you up to go to university and into the workplace, how do you set your athletes to go through junior basketball into senior basketball to be a professional, to be a collegiate player, whatever the story is. So we'll use the term teaching and learning through here a fair bit, but I think that's a good place to start. All of this is teaching that we will speak about.
Absolutely, and some people do it better than others, obviously, but I think the big thing is you can always be improving on it. So there's different ways you can assess your teaching. It's not as simple as, can this player now perform the skill that I was trying to teach them? It's not usually as simple as that. So there's a little bit more to it, but probably the first area we've identified, good coaches or good teachers are player developers. So this is a little bit of a shelve of the ego exercise, I suppose. It's not necessarily just about the win and the loss of what does your record look like as a coach and how many titles do you have. The ultimate assessment of if you've been a good coach or not will be, have your athletes improved?
I think it's the ultimate compliment is if you can be told that your players are better for having played for you or with you in your team, or people see athletes that you've coached 2 or 3 years ago and can comment on their development or evolution as an athlete. That is the ultimate compliment as a coach. It has nothing to do with championships, wins or losses. That's high performing. That's the professional ranks. That's the overseas international basketball ranks. But the ultimate compliment has to be your player is much better for the experience that they had with you.
It is. And it gets lost. I mean, given our kids play so many games, there's tournaments on all the time. They have a domestic game, a school game, a club game. potentially some high performance leagues, say AJCs and things like that, it gets lost, I think, along the way. And I know our state coaches ask us a lot, what is the actual mandate here? Is there a mandate we have to try and win gold medals, or is there a mandate to try and get kids into Australian teams down the road somewhere?
Yeah.
And it's a difficult question to answer, because really it's both. So there is an element of, you've got to juggle.
Bit of a balancing act. Yeah, absolutely.
But ultimately, absolutely, we want our athletes to be better athletes,
yeah,
at the end of it. And, you know, it is a little bit of a gauge. I know when I've taken teams in the past, I always look at where the kids end up the next season. And just sort of find out. And it's like, if one of the two of those kids might make a first team as a bottom age kid, and it's like, well, okay, I gave them a good chance. Obviously, some kids fall away down the other end, and it's not that you've done a bad job with them. It's just sometimes they don't fit wherever they may need to fit,
yep,
for team selection. But the big thing is, you've got to develop the athletes. And we've spoken about it a number of times on the podcast as well. And there's lots of different ways that you need to develop them. There's the mental side, there's the physical side, there's the skill side in general.
I think there's a few, like off the bat, like if I went and watched some athletes or kids play basketball, you can tell if they're well coached or developed through how they stop. Like, actually, can they stop? So we're talking about 2-foot stops. Can they stop? Can they pivot on both feet in both directions? So you got 4 pivots. And can they catch? And can they do all 3 of those things? If they can catch, stop, and pivot, that shows to me progression and development. And the reality is, if those 3 things there are a base for your athlete, like you're under 12 fours athletes this year, if that's a base that you're trying to put into your athletes, they can get better at all the other stuff as they get older and older. If they miss out on those 3 things, which are early identifiers for me in my role, I think it's not hard to teach, but they are a step behind, and you are playing catch up after that.
No question. And it is probably one of the first things that I think gets undertaught a lot, is just basic body movement skills. It's taken for granted a lot, and we sort of expect that, okay, the schools will take care of that in their PE classes and things like that. But sometimes our kids just cannot run properly. They don't understand how to do it. They don't really know how to move laterally yet. They've never had to do it. By the time we get them and we try and put them basketball in their hand, and we're trying to get them to start and stop and things like that as well, we're asking too much of them.
It's a bit of a product of our time constraints here that we get to work with our athletes. Like, how many hours did you get with your group this year?
1 game and 2 training sessions on a half court.
So like 90 minutes, 2 times a week practice?
Yeah, I think maybe a 90 and a 60.
Okay, so you know, 2.5 hours you get. How much time do we have to practice starting and stopping?
Yep.
And I can see how a coach with a time constraint like that needs to get their offense in, needs to get their press break in, needs to get all shooting in, need to get all this important stuff in. Starting and stopping is the actual most important thing, and it's a product of the time over here. I watch a lot of coaches' clinics, I watch a lot of practices. I think the listeners would be blown away with the quality of coaches. I'm talking high major Division I and NBA, who have built into their practice plans every single day starting, stopping, catching, and pivoting. Like, it is super elementary, super fundamental. But they're those habits that they're trying to create, so that when it's a tight ball game with a minute to go, they can actually execute a start, stop, and a pivot.
Yep. And I was only reading something that one of our listeners sent through just a couple of days ago about how much is too much in terms of teaching kids. And it spoke a little bit about, if you try and have them master 8 or 9 things straight away, they'll struggle with all of them. They won't get good at any of them. And their enjoyment and their love for the game will go away fairly quickly. Like, they won't achieve anything along the way. Whereas if you can get them to master 2 or 3 things, they'll feel like they've accomplished something. Their enjoyment for the game goes up, and now they want to keep practicing so they can achieve more things.
Yeah. Yep.
So it all ties in there. So we do need to look at what we do at training and the creativity part of the training as well. Like, let them experiment, let them trial and error. We had Dr. Adam Gorman on a couple of weeks ago, yep, who spoke about almost the lost art of pickup, where kids just don't get to go and be creative and try dumb stuff and, yep, you know, try and shoot, you know, the running sky hook or whatever it is. They don't get to do that anymore, right, because we usually have them in fairly constrained environments, whereas allowing them to trial and error a little bit more. And hey, it happened with my 12s this year. There'd be a couple of times where someone would drive down the lane and they'd throw just like the most ridiculous pass, and there's a part of me just biting my tongue and saying, this is not ideal. But there's another part of me that says, well, you know what, you've obviously seen the kid is open and you can't get it through, you know, in the traditional way of a push pass or whatever, but you've managed to throw it behind your head somehow. Well, so be it.
Yep.
Like, it's, yep, we want to encourage that vision.
Yeah, and we're in awe of how Europeans play soccer and basketball, or
flair is probably football. The big word.
They use the word flair, or in people that observe, they use the word flair a lot. And flair's the creativity that's allowed in those environments of unstructured 5-on-5 or 4-on-4, whatever it is, 3-on-3, but also the understanding that you have to kind of allow that at an age so that they can execute those actions and skills in a competitive environment. So there's a lot to be said for kind of providing that as a guide.
And as a developer, you do need to be aware of all the different types of learning cycles as well. So your macro cycles, your meso cycles, your micro cycles. Oh, this is Robbie, starting to sound a little bit scientific. But you do need to be across, well, okay, when am I putting this in? How long do they have to learn this? Am I setting them up for failure by giving them too much, or is this part of the bigger picture? I know on one of the other podcasts, I think you might have been you, Mike, and certainly wasn't Justin, it was too logical for Justin. You can't be a good on-ball defense team if you've only started a month before. You need to start planning for that 12 months before and then work to that.
Right.
And so it's the same with player development. You need to be organized with your planning.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think a big part, the final part to all that we've just spoken about, is with player development, comes a belief in your ability and skill. So if the environment you create and the importance you put on developing skill within your practice environment is there, then your athletes are over time going to have more and more of a belief in their skill and ability. And without that belief, they've got no chance of executing it when they need to in a game or a competitive situation. So with all of this, the repetition, with the creativity, with knowing that you as a coach value player development, gives them the understanding that they will get better. And as you were a basketball player back in the day, Robbie, you will know that when players feel themselves getting better, they are open to instruction and teaching. And unless they feel that progression and that they are getting better, that's hard for them to get that buy-in. So a belief that they're getting better is huge.
Yep. So you lie to your athletes is what you're saying, and sometimes you need to just tell them, hey, you're really improving on this, when you're not really getting there?
No, Robbie. I conduct an honest program, Robbie.
I'm sure. So one of the best player developers we could think of when we were talking about this was Jay Wright.
Unbelievable.
Great college coach, obviously. Bit of a factory they've got going on there at the moment, where it's just elite athlete after elite athlete gets brought out and you see their success.
But they don't come in as McDonald's All-Americans. Correct. Or five-star recruits. They develop athletes over time. They have redshirted athletes in the past who have sat out their freshman year, played 2 years or 3 years after that, and gone to the NBA. And they bring athletes in, and they are fully aware that this program is a player development program. You will get better at footwork, shooting, dexterity, and defensive fundamentals. And that's what the basis of the success that they've had in the last three seasons is off.
And no shock, when we speak about it all the time, if you want a good team, get good players.
Yep.
And if you can't get good players, or you can't recruit your five-star guys, build them.
Yep.
So you've got to have a coachable kid.
Exactly. What's next, Robbie? That's number one.
Next.
What's number
tactical.
Two?
You've got to have a rough idea on what's actually going on with the game.
It helps, Robbie.
Your X's and O's.
It helps.
So it's not always relevant to every coach. Obviously, in my case, coaching under 12s, there wasn't a whole lot of tactical stuff going on. Like you might change from a half court man to a full court man, or vice versa.
Okay,
so
for under 12s, what is some tactic that came in? Any thought?
Can't zone.
Yeah.
So the big thing is, if you can't zone now, your half court trap kind of goes away. The big thing for us tactically is, can we break the press?
Yeah.
And so we did a lot of work early on. We gave them really basic rules around a press break. But a lot of our work early on was just spread the floor, space, play with pace where you can. If you can throw the ball ahead, throw the ball ahead. So our tactics really weren't all that. I mean, our pre-game talk, honestly, went for 40 seconds at most every week. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you guys are on, full court man. Try and keep the ball in front of you as best you can. If someone's open, throw it to them. Yep. 1, 2, 3, off we go.
I think that's important. And the age group that you're coaching, the level that you're coaching, is what the... What does tactic and X's and O's look like for you? With under 12 boys and girls here in Melbourne, spacing would be the tactic. How do you get your athletes to hold space on the floor, create good angles on the floor, able to create penetration or pass penetration or cutting penetration to create an open shot for somebody?
Yep.
And a thing for me, if I was watching an under 12 game, if I could see a team that could hold space and shoot open jump shots, that would lead me to believe that those athletes are following instruction, because the typical under 12 game would have a ball and six or seven kids around that ball.
Yep. With the instruction to drive it constantly. Correct. Like, and in all honesty, it was something we only managed to get the hang of later in the season.
Yeah.
Of actually taking an open jump shot. Yeah. Like, there's that real mentality, and especially in the younger ages.
I think that's an under 12 tactic. Absolutely.
It's, and of course, you're going to make more layups than you are jump shots in under 12s. It's going to work. But getting them to actually have the confidence to shoot the ball was really difficult. And it took a lot of work at training to get to that point as well.
I think the other part to all this is X's and O's. Everyone loves watching YouTube and picking up the latest set out of the NBA or the NCAA, but how much is too much and what is over the top, and how much can you get your athletes to actually understand? That's the big part of tactics and X's and O's, of what can you get really, really good at and what your athletes are going to have the most successes in. And just because you like the look of the set, and I've heard this a million times, just because you like the look of a set, if your team can't run it, then throw it out. It's done. There's no point having it in your playbook with that team. Doesn't mean you can't bring it back next year or the year after, but how much is too much, and what is going to set your athletes up tactically for the most success?
Well, and simple is usually better. Like, there are plenty of sets out there, and we see it in EuroLeague all the time, where we look at it and go, wow. Yeah. Like, there is so much action going on. How do you possibly defend all of this? Ultimately, if it comes down to a middle pick and roll, you've just got to stay in front until that middle pick and roll. So it may not suit your group anyway. Simple is better. Get your best players in a position where they can go and damage the scoreboard. Like, that's what you're after.
It's interesting because some NBA teams, and I'm sure pro teams here in Australia and in Europe, chart passes. With more passes also comes more opportunity of turnover as well.
Yep.
So it's an interesting correlation between the two. If a high passing team would actually be a high turnover team as well, but the fact that they create more offensive possessions, it weighs itself out. So that's something to keep in mind with your X's and O's as well. Game planning falls into here as well. So at the under 12 level, it'd be a little bit different. You really just want to get your fundamentals on the floor.
Yep.
You want your kids to play well, shoot the ball when they're open, be motivated at the end of the game to come to practice the next time. As you get older, state teams, working in the national teams, pro big V's, Siebel leagues here in Melbourne, the game plan does matter, and how you present that game plan to your team is really interesting. And I think that we might have spoken about this before, but I think the one that is most common is you have the opposition tape, you watch what they do offensively, and this is how we will defend their three sets that they run most often. The part that gets overlooked a little bit is how do they defend stuff defensively, and how does that prepare you to run a particular action that you're good at, or how does that prepare you to attack something that you perceive as a weakness for them? So just thinking back to my Werribee squad last year, if I could see that a team that we were playing against had a team that did not close out on the ball too well, how were we going to create long closeouts so that our athletes would have an advantage? So just things like that, like what is that weakness that you can pick on of the other team? That's game planning.
And you bang on the money, because I think the scout's really relevant. One of the things I always want to know is what do they do with on-ball screens? Yeah. And I will usually, if I know that they're a hard show team, I'll usually put an on-ball screen in our first offensive set just to find out if they're still a hard show team, or if they change that over the course of the week as well. It's like sending a cutter through to find out if they're in man or zone that first possession. So there's a little bit of tactical stuff that goes with that as well. Obviously, the defensive side of the ball is a really important thing. I've usually been a really big advocate of, hey, here are our rules, and we just stick with those rules regardless. So we're going to gap them through. When you down screen, that's our rule. And any time we see that action, we know what our rule is, and we just stick with that rather than overcomplicated. I hear people say that, hey, I've got five different ways of defending the on ball. It's like, well, that's great.
But four too many.
How many of them work? So I know the NBA guys are really big on just send it away from the on ball.
Yeah.
So if it's a wing on ball, they'll turn ice it, or if it's mid pick, they'll just send it away from
There's some great clips online of our boomers in 2016. Yep. Do you remember those Olympics were, Robbie? 2016?
I do,
2016.
Spain.
Rio, somewhere Robbie.
In
Spain.
Come on,
Spain.
Right. We have discussed.
Cannot do geography.
Not geography.
Some awesome clips of our boomers doing exactly what you just said. Just ball doesn't even get to the screen. Send the ball away. I think the last part of tactical and X's and O's that maybe develops in a coach is the situational stuff. Because it does come as a bit of a product of the amount of games you coach and your experiences. But I have a group of clown mates who make fun of basketball as you don't need to watch the first 40 or 36 minutes, but if you can turn it on with 4 minutes to go in the game, the score will generally be 81-77, and now the game's on. They say everything gets to that 4 minutes and that's the game, which is a fair assessment of our great sport. We do have a lot of games where in a game plan, you say, let's keep this game within two possessions with 4 minutes to go and let's go win the game. And that does get, that is the game. So how you play at the end of the game is really interesting. Go-to sets, isolation plays, side out of bounds, need three with 8 seconds to go, need two with 12 seconds, down one, fouling, not fouling, how do you create more possessions? All that becomes situational, which is really a product of how much you coach and how long you've been coaching for.
Yep, absolutely. So one of the best tacticians we've seen in the game, and he gets spoken about constantly for his work at both the college and the NBA level, obviously
Robbie Coulter.
No, I don't know. Very much no. I don't even know I'd been coach of the year in my under-12 competition this year, unfortunately. But Brad Stevens is one of the best. It's very rare you can go 2 or 3 days in the NBA season without saying, hey, look at this new tweak he's put in with his group, or this wrinkle that he's starting to do with his defense, like whatever it is. Like, he's just amazing mentally, I think.
Yeah, and he is the first to say that so much of the stuff that he does and puts in is stolen from somewhere else.
Yep.
Which is coaching. Like, it's the wheel has been invented. Yes. But he would only take stuff that suits his personnel and philosophy on it. So he's got, yeah, back to YouTube, he's got some unbelievable packages on there with end of game, inside out of bounds, end of game, short clock stuff.
Yep. Incredible stuff. So our next one is, you must be a good communicator.
Number 3. And
this is, it seems like a really throwaway type comment, but if you can't communicate with your athletes, it doesn't matter. And that spirals a little bit, I suppose, that you must be able to communicate with athletes, but you almost must be able to communicate with their parents if they're at a junior level. Yep. Like, it's, I get it, like some people see parents and run a mile, but you need to be able to communicate with them as well. Mm. And as well as, you know, potentially office staff, coaching directors, those sorts of things as
boards, committees,
it all counts.
I think it's the point of difference with all of this stuff that we're going to talk about is your ability to communicate. Like, I do think it sets coaches apart. It sets people in the professional world apart, like the high school teachers, university professors, the people that you know when you're in the presence of a good communicator. I hope we don't mumble or stumble on any of these words, Robbie, while we're talking about communicating. But you just know when you're in the room with somebody who has a presence, they've got a commanding word, they're articulate, they are strong in their belief of what they're saying. It just it's there, and you kind of leave those kind of situations like, that was awesome. Like, we've all been in that presentation where we're like, that was really good. We've also been in the presentation where it's like, that was 45 minutes. Yeah, that was a really, really struggle.
Yeah.
So a part of communication is being articulate. Like, how can you command your word? Does it actually describe exactly what you want your athletes or your kids on the floor to do? Or the expectation, or if you're in a team meeting or you're in a film room, what is the communication, and do people understand what you're trying to say? The next thing I've got down is there's got to be an element of motivation to it as well. And those that do know me, I'm not rah-rah at all, but I do think that your ability to motivate athletes with your word has to be present. And I think what's really cool when I watch the AFL is how many of those head coaches, they stand in front of the group, and you see John Longmire's awesome. He stands in front of the Sydney Swans group and he's just like bursting out of his polo shirt. He's got a presence. He's pointing. He's communicating. The Scott brothers are the same. Clarkson's the same. When they stand in front of the group, you can just see that all eyes are on them. And I think it's a really awesome, awesome thing. And presence was one of my next points. Like, what kind of presence do you have in front of your group? Is, do you instill a belief in them that this next 90 minutes of practice is going to be integral to us winning the game on Friday night?
And it's huge, because realistically, there are times where we need to get the attention of all 10 athletes or 12 athletes, depending on what you've got on your squad. and you want them to feel like you're only talking to them at times.
Yep.
Like you need to have that presence about you, but also command their attention with that as well. Now, that can obviously be disciplined as well. You might have a coach from a young age that says, hey, when I'm talking, you must eyeball me and things like that. But realistically, that might be at a timeout where it can't happen because they're getting a drink or whatever the case may be. But you need to know that they're locked in and engaged with it. If you're a good communicator, that won't be a problem.
Right.
Like they'll want to hear and they'll always want more. And that's probably the hard part. And I say this as I ramble on a podcast near on every week, is you kind of want to leave them wanting a little bit more every time. You don't want to overstimulate them by giving them too many words, but you want to leave them to a point where you're not making the decision for them as well. You need to let them make the read.
Exactly. And good players, doesn't matter what sport, they want to be coached. So that's on the athlete's part, that is on them. Like if they want to be a good athlete, they've got to want to embrace coaching and take on coaching. So that part's on them. I think there's two parts to it. There's the discipline part, which you spoke about, which is absolute. Like this is the way we're going to do things. There has to be a standard and an expectation around exactly how we're going to do A, B, and C. Then there's also the empowerment. Like how can you communicate to your athletes that I'm empowering you to go and play the game? Because at the end of the day, they play the game. You can teach it from the sideline, but they've got to go out and play it. And how you set them up to do that is really coming from your presence and your talk.
And that ties into the body language side of things. Like you spoke about it before, you're not a rah-rah coach. And we've all seen those coaches that run up and down the sidelines, they sprint, they jump, you know, they carry on. Physically, I'm not actually capable of doing that, so I've never been that kind of coach. But we all see those coaches. And personally, I hate coaching against them because there's a part of me that just says, oh, would you just shut up? It's like, just relax, let your players play. But if that's what they need to do to get their players up and about, well, that just might be the type of team they have. Like they need to bring the energy for their athletes. Now, you'll be exhausted at the end of the season if that's the type of team you have. But that simply might be a way to get your kids up and going that might be in just a little bit of a funk at the time.
With all of this, the word that stands out is authenticity. So your communication has to be authentic. If that is you, to rah-rah, up and down the sideline, coach every pass, every possession, then you have to kind of do that, because if you don't, the athletes are like, what's going on here? So there has to be a level of authenticity. If you are not a rah-rah person and you start yelling, screaming and swearing, that goes to the other end of the spectrum. Then the athletes and the players are thinking, this is fake.
Yep.
Okay, so authenticity in how you communicate, and again, that comes to you knowing who you are as well, and reflecting on your philosophies and how you want this game taught.
Absolutely. And I mean, how you want this game taught is a really relevant point, because one of the ones I had down here is attention to detail when teaching. I've long been a believer that you're better off giving less detail and let them have more time. So I'd sort of work on that, you know, 1 minute explanation to 10 minutes of actual game or gameplay when teaching is around about right. I sort of find that any more than that, they can start to wander off mentally. It's just not where it needs to be.
The other part to that is, so you talked about teaching or instructing a drill. If you think about your program as a whole, are you better off having less stuff and more detail in the stuff that you want to do? Like we're not going to run 100 plays. We'll run these three, but I'm going to be able to communicate every detail of every action, of every cut, of every expectation across the game. And that's the other part to teaching and communicating that detail.
And it ties in a little bit with the next point that we're going to get to as well, but just the ability to understand the situation you're in. So there might be times where it's really tense and you can see like your players are almost shaking, they're so nervous and things like that. Just the ability to be able to bring them back down again and not overly stimulate them as well. And that could be, you know, have a joke with someone or something like that, just to make sure that everyone's still on level footing. It's a really big thing. Or how do you pick a player up when they're feeling down?
Mm.
Like they may have missed a really important shot, and that you can see that's affected them mentally. The ability to communicate with them is really important. You know, that might be, hey, sub them out and you go and have a chat with them rather than the assistant coach, whatever the case may be. But if you can't communicate it, you're going to really struggle to get buy-in from your athletes from there.
Absolutely. Who is our star communicator?
We have gone Steve Kerr for our star communicator. There's some outstanding clips out there from his time with Steph Curry.
Yeah.
Read an article the other day about how he's going to coach DeMarcus Cousins, and he's like, Draymond Green's been preparing me this for the last 3 years. Like, Cousins will not be a problem.
Yeah.
Like, if I can coach Draymond, I can coach anyone. And they talk about, there are times where they have just stand-up fights at practice where Kerr and Draymond will be yelling at each other from across the court, and you know, it gets fairly heated, and essentially practice just stops. But by the same token, when it's done, it's done. And they don't dwell on it. They walk off the practice court together and they're all fine.
Yep.
So there's clearly a level of respect there between the two of them where it works.
It's interesting. So he does have that really calm demeanor that you see in the, he's got his arm around Steph Curry, he's talking and he's teaching and all. He's got that calm persona. And then the referee blows a decision and he is off that bench and he is hunting and swearing and cursing. And it's just interesting how, and that's the competitiveness in him. He can get away with it because he's Golden State Warriors head coach. Yep. But it's interesting how he can communicate those two different things. And he has got that softer teaching mentor side. And then he has that ferocious competitor, which came from obviously years as being an elite basketball player himself. Yep.
So our next one is culture and environment.
Number four, Robbie.
You must be able to create a culture and environment with your athletes where they want to improve, they want to be there, they have standards, they have expectations on them. Because as you said before, athletes want to be coached or taught. So if they're going to come in there and you're not going to teach them, you're quickly going to lose them. So it's a fine line between how much is too much. Like, do you spend too much time doing team building activities and things like that? When you could have your kids on court. But it is a really big thing, and we hear it. I mean, culture is one of those words again that gets thrown around a lot. Oh, the culture is great, the culture of this, and you can tell. But it is a really valuable part of it, and you know, it's that whole legacy by James Kerr. You know, you want to leave the place better than where you found it.
Absolutely.
So culture is a really big thing with a lot of teams.
Yeah, and out of that book, the James Kerr book, environment was the word that I took out of that. The environment you create is essentially the product. The human is going to be the product of the environment that you create. So it was one of the first things that I thought about when I took this role a couple of years ago was, what environment do we want to create for our athletes that, and our coaches as well, that walk in the gym? What's the expectation? Is this going to be a teaching and learning environment? Is this going to be a competitive environment? Like, what and that can change camp to camp or practice to practice, but what environment do you want to create? Camps, NITPs, workouts, state teams, all of that comes under that umbrella. And teaching and learning was the big one. Like, this had to have been, when you're talking about 14, 15, 16 year old kids, this has to be a teaching and learning environment. And we had some great meetings with coaches from around Melbourne that, and the instruction and the discussion was, don't take it for granted that the kids know anything, okay? As a coach, be open to learning and teaching new things and working on your craft, but let's go straight back to the basics and create this environment, which is like the classroom. And let's teach the fundamentals, and then as they get older, hopefully it sets a good base and foundation for them moving forward.
And it's hard to get. Like, it's hard to get buy-in. Like, whilst people want to be taught, I think everyone's probably got a little bit of skepticism about them, and that a player comes in or a coach comes in that you may not be familiar with, and it's like, let's see what they're about before we jump straight into this, and then you can get a gauge of it from there.
Just think about professional sports and how hard it is to create a good environment, and how many times you hear of issues from within professional clubs.
Yep.
Like, you hear it all the
time. The Jailblazers era is still in my head.
But think about... And think about, talk the NBA. The teams that have, for the last two decades, struggled to get out of that bottom tier of whatever conference or division they're in, like, how difficult it has been for them to come out of there. And you need a special person. The Melbourne Demons, they get a chance to lose a final next week against Geelong. And they had 12 years having played. But how hard it was for Paul Ruse and the management that took over at the time to get the club to where it is now. And the reality with environments and cultures is not everyone can do it. Really, really tough to do. That's why CEOs are poached from company to company to company and paid exorbitant amounts of money to not do anything other than create an environment and set a culture. And a coach that can do that can obviously set their athletes up for successes.
Well, and again, it's such an incredibly valuable part of it, because without your culture, really, you're only as good as your talent. And right. Talent will only get you so far, ultimately. And you want people continually coming back and seeking more. And as you say, it's that growth environment. You want them to come back and seek you out a little bit more. And sometimes that requires you to listen a little bit more than you talk.
Yeah,
so that's the hard part, is that you might need to listen to a player, to a parent, to whoever that might be. But you just need to sit there and go, hey, I'll hear this one out, because they might be coming at a completely different angle than I am. You might be seeing something I'm not seeing. But all of a sudden, if you buy into that a little bit as well, they'll feel ownership.
Mm.
And so now it's a little bit of a two-way street with the communication. We'd all love to dictate and say, no, this is how it is, and we're only doing it this way, and that's it. But it doesn't work that way.
Right.
Like, you're just going to piss a lot of people off, frankly. So you just need to get to a point where your culture is that, hey, this is a little bit of a 360-degree feedback. We're going to tell you what we want, but we need to hear what you need as well. I don't know, we did it with our seed women roughly halfway through the year. We sat down with them, gave them some questions and said, hey, look, you know, what do you think you could be doing better? How do you feel like you're going? But what could we be doing better? Like, do you need to be coached differently? Do you need more feedback, less feedback, whatever the case may be? And we got great results out of it.
It's a great point. Like, and it's a bit of a home truth. Like, just think about yourself, what coaching, your workplace, the home, what kind of environment are you creating? And I think we've spoke about it. The best companies, the best teams, the best cultures have the environment that backs all of this up. So
and you look at the Spurs in the NBA, obviously. Like, look at the amount of GMs, front office staff, coaches that are now in the league that have been through the Spurs organization.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. Like, their head coaches somewhere else, their front offices, their assistant coaches somewhere. They're everywhere. So you look at that Spurs culture and environment, it's obviously a really strong one, but it's interesting to hear that they don't have signs up around there preaching their culture either.
Mm.
It's just expected, and it was from the Tim Duncan days, and they talk about it a lot, that why is the culture here so good? And it's like, the first day of practice I rolled in and Tim Duncan got chewed out, and he just sat there and said, yep, got it.
Right.
And, like, didn't fight back. He just wanted to be coached.
It comes from the top. Like, that's one thing that I'm certain of. Like, your environment and culture is set from the top, and the expectations, and I don't like to use the word rules, but the standards that you set for your organization, they come from the top. And back to the CEO point, that's why they are so valued in businesses, because they can drive that culture and environment from the top.
Absolutely. So the one of the best examples of culture we had was Alistair Clarkson.
Awesome.
So you look at Hawthorn over the last decade, really, they've been one of the best teams in the competition.
Yeah.
To a point where they can trade away one of their best and most storied franchise players, and everyone sits there and goes, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Like, no one questioned it and said, hey, this is horrible, you shouldn't be doing this. It's like, no, we understand.
It was Jordy Lewis the year before. Yep. It was Hodge. There's talk about Roughhead now. But what they've created is an environment where those guys get better every single year. Like, if you look at Luke Bruce and the guys that played lesser roles 4 or 5 years ago, they are now the guys that got chosen as All-Australians last night. Like, it's unbelievable the development that those guys get from within that footy club. And I've never had a chance to visit, but everything I hear out of there is that the environment and the culture and the standards that are set, that just drives everything on the field.
It might be a nice little opportunity for us to maybe head down there at some. We may need to wait until outside of finals, otherwise you'll be classed as a spy or something.
Mr. Clarkson is an avid listener, I'm told.
Yeah, we might see if we can get down there. So our last point on what makes a great coach.
Yep.
They must be a learner or an information seeker. So they can't rest on their laurels and say, hey, I'm a really good coach and I'm pretty content with where I'm at and I'm not going to go and experiment or try and find more things out. We want the people that want to go out there and learn and ask questions and seek out different ways to do things, or what's the latest trend out of somewhere else, like, how can I get better? And that's what we really want in coaches, I feel like, is those people that go and seek out the information. They have good networks.
Yeah.
They go and talk to other people and find out what everyone else does.
Absolutely. Warren Buffett, you know Mr. Buffett, Robbie?
Yep.
I hope he is handling your money for you.
If only.
It's a far-fetched example, but he speaks about that. Like, he reads for like 5 or 6 hours a day now. Yep. Now, he's got the luxury to do that, and I'm not saying that anybody listening to this or you and me could read for 5 or 6 hours a day, but it's his investment in himself, which I think is the moral to that story. Like, how are you going to... And Justin, when he was a member of the pod, used to talk about this a lot, was how are you investing in yourself? And you have to be willing to put other things aside to, if it is something that you want to get better at, set a good culture, be a better player developer, whatever it is, how are you going to get there? And a really good book out there, Robbie. It's called The One Thing. And it's exactly about that. Like, how... What is the one thing that you can do that would make everything in your life better? Or what is the one thing that you could do that can help you achieve what you want to achieve? And it's spelt out really well in the book about people have so many things going. You got work, you got family, you got life, you got social, you got religion, you got all these things, you got basketball. If you are telling yourself you want to do A, but B, C, D, E, and F are influencing A, it's really hard to excel at that one thing. And it's a great read, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. Like, how can you set out a plan for you to become better at, we're talking about teaching basketball here, how can you set out that plan? And there is obviously ways to go about it.
And there are informal ways and there are formal ways. You can obviously go and do courses or attend clinics and things like that, which will get you better as a coach. But there are also really informal things, like just your coach's network. Like, who do you reach out to? Who do you go and talk to? Some of the best conversations I've ever had have been just informal chats with people that I've happened to bump into at a stadium or down at the shops or something like that. And it's just a, hey, how's this going? And you just have a chat with them and you just get different ways to do it. I'm lucky that I get to present coaching courses. So every time I go in there, there's at least 10 coaches or so with different takes on different things. And you know, we'll throw them on court and say, hey, who's got the best ball handling drill? And someone will always do something that I've never seen before. And it's like, okay, I don't mind that. Like, I'll take that and I'll steal it and I'll put my own little twist on it. But the network itself is really good. There's a stack of information out there and a ton of good people that are happy to share it as well.
Absolutely.
Like, it's it really is as big as you want to make it.
And that's very much what we speak about, and having that network of coaches who are willing to share. We're in a dangerous spot here in our country because there are so few full-time basketball jobs, which has a detriment on our willingness to be happy for someone else to have successes in their current job.
Tall poppy syndrome, essentially.
A bit of that. Yeah. A bit of that. So there is ways that we can do a much better job of being a willing sharer. I do think that you've got to be very careful to understand that a coaching course, like a level two coaching course.
Association, mate. Get it right.
Excuse me, Roberto. An association coaching course is an accreditation. So that does not necessarily mean that you are actively learning the game of basketball. Yep. So that's a real big distinction that needs to be made. I truly think the best form of professional development or learning the game is watching someone else's practice.
Yep.
Like, literally going there for 90 minutes, sitting there, notebook, pen, and writing down everything you see is really, really good learning.
Yep.
And that means that you've got to be willing to pick up the phone, shoot a text, get out, drive and go and watch something. But I pick up more than anything when I go to another practice.
And it's funny, Tom Thibodeau did that in his year in between the Bulls and the Timberwolves at the moment. He effectively just wandered around the country, and great again when you've got the budget to do that. Watched other teams train, watched college, watched soccer, didn't care. Like, he went and just watched how other people taught, what they did, how they did it, and is now applying a lot of that stuff into his own coaching as well.
And the other part to it is, it doesn't have to always be basketball.
Yep.
You can learn a lot from any other sport, other genders, competitions, whatever it is. You can learn by just putting yourself out there. The other one is, I just have it written down here, Robbie, is I just wrote down the word coffee. And you don't have to drink the coffee. Robbie's a chai latte drinker. If anyone wants to buy Robbie a coffee next time they see him. But going and just grabbing a coffee, offering to someone to buy them lunch, because I just want to pick your brain on something. That's awesome. And I hear about, and on the business side of things, that people that want to make it in business, real estate, whatever it is, they try to find the guy who is selling the most real estate, having great successes with investing, and just offering them, can I buy you lunch? I'd love to talk to you about your next project. And I think that's an awesome way to firstly build that network that we just spoke about, but also intimately take one or two things that you can bring to what you're doing.
Absolutely. So tons of examples out there. Obviously, most coaches are learners, but three that we highlighted more than anything. So Nancy Lieberman, Becky Hammond, Jenny Butcher. So three female coaches, which is fantastic, but have gone out of their way to go and learn.
Yep.
Like, so Becky Hammond's a great example. Jumped in when she was rehabbing her ACL to Spurs practice.
And just
went and found out and just observed.
Yep.
So before long, she's in team meetings, she's in, you know, talking to players, and you know, finishes her playing career.
Yep.
She's now an assistant coach.
Yep.
So these are three ladies that all have had great coaching careers in their own right.
Yep.
But have gone a little bit above and beyond, I think, to go and learn more.
Absolutely.
So time on NBA benches, WNBA as well, they've been outstanding servants of the game. And it's great to see them giving back as former players as well.
Becky Hammond at San Antonio, Nancy Lieberman with the Sacramento Kings, and Jenny, Robbie, it's Buchek. It's European, Buchek. Mate. Come on, mate. Sorry, mate. At Dallas, and she is just starting. Coach Buchek was Seattle Storm's head coach. So she's actually gone from coaching in the WNBA to now coaching in the NBA. And I think it's awesome how they've identified situations and head coaching that they want to be involved with and be able to take away to help build their and shape their philosophies. Absolutely. So,
and an outstanding role model for other coaches as well, female coaches. The gender is no issue in this. Like, if you want that job, go get that job. Like, I think it's a fantastic thing.
We need to get away from, in our country, of talking about male and female coaches.
Absolutely.
Like, basketball coach needs to be the way that we talk about each other in this profession, because it is completely irrelevant what the league is, the gender you're coaching. You can either teach it or you can't teach it. And I think that's a clear distinction that we should make. The other part to this is, and I've heard a bunch of stories of coaches that have foregone salaries to volunteer or put themselves out there to volunteer in a situation just to absorb knowledge. And Brad Stevens did it. He had a really good job as a pharmaceutical salesman in Indiana, gave up his job and went and volunteered at Butler before he even got on staff at Butler. So there is a bit of backing yourself in as well, but putting yourself in an environment, as those three ladies have, where you can keep that learning going.
Yep. So we sort of figure if you can cover off these 5 points, this will make, it'll give you at least a chance to be a pretty good coach.
Absolutely. I think all five of them, and they're all works in progress. Like, I'm just thinking about myself. I want to be a better player developer. I want to be a better communicator, environment creator. These are always works in progress, and the coaches at the top of the tree would tell you that these five things here for them are the things that they don't ever want to be finished getting better at.
No, absolutely agree. So
go through them again, Robbie. What was the first one?
So we had player developer.
Yep.
Tactical, so X's and O's.
Yep.
Communicator, culture and environment, and learner information seeker.
Yep.
So awesome. That's what we think will give you the best chance anyway.
Yeah. There's other things that...
There's heaps of other stuff. Like, similar as really, there was with the players. Yep. Like, there's heaps of other stuff you can put in there as well. But these were the five that we sort of picked out that we thought would be good.
If you get good at these, Robbie, you'll be a hell of a coach.
I might move up to like a number 12 threes or something like that in the future. We'll see.
I hope you can keep the boy who said it was a pleasure for you to coach. You guys meet again in under 18s.
A very, very good chance, in all honesty. We'll see how it plays out. So we can use this week. WNBA finals are on at the moment, down to the last four teams.
Awesome.
We have a number of Australians involved. Obviously, Sandy Brondello is the head coach of the Phoenix Mercury.
Yep.
Steph Talbot in that group as well, who's playing with Melbourne Boomers this year. Mm-hmm. Lelani Mitchell, who's playing with Canberra in the WNBL, which is great. The standard of basketball's been fantastic. Tarozzi went off in yesterday's game that I saw.
Fadeaway three from the corner to tie it up. That was something else.
Everyone knows where the ball's going, but it doesn't matter. Like, it's,
and that's player development right there, Robbie.
Comes into it.
Great stop and catch in the corner.
Well, maybe tactical. Pretty good from Sandy to get that shot away as well. But yeah, it'll be great to see how those finals play out. Hopefully we see some Australians in the final. And just honestly, go and watch some of those games. Some of the athletes in that are amazing. Tarozzi, I can't even tell you how old she is at the moment. But she is still peak game. Sue Bird playing for Seattle is still an amazing
athlete. Sue Bird,
athlete,
awesome.
At 37,
awesome.
I think.
Overhead pass the other day, unbelievable.
Incredible, unbelievable. In transition. Yeah. Like, Elena Deladon got injured yesterday, but all accounts she will be back for the next game.
Brianna Stewart was the WNBA MVP,
yep.
Am I right?
Absolutely amazing.
She is a star, yep.
So I do recommend you go and have a look at some of those games. They are fantastic basketball to watch. Keeping it in the States.
Oh, no.
Manu,
the retirement.
He's no more. How very unspursish this Spurs team looks now. Like, I remember growing up with the Duncan, Ginobili, Parker, the little trio.
Mm-hmm.
It's just no more. Manu, though, an incredible career. Four-time NBA champion, Olympic gold medalist in 2004.
Yep. Where was that, Robbie?
Where was that?
Athens.
Very good.
What country is that in?
Greece.
Well done.
Spain. Greece. Yeah, not everything's in Spain, it turns out. Euro Cup champion in 2001 with Bologna, which is in Italy.
Yeah, well done.
Spain, so very near Spain, but an incredible career. Like, you can look at guys that have really made their mark in the sport, like you look at Jordan and guys like that are just amazing, but The game will never be the same without Manu. That Euro step, like one of my favourite memories is when he went down and caught the bat on court that somehow managed to be in the stadium. Like, the guy is just a legend and came up clutch so many times for the Spurs as well.
He started in the Spurs in 02, which would have made me just turn 16, Robbie. So mm-hmm. he was fair and square, one of the guys that I grew up watching and just blown away. His European highlight clip package before he even went to the NBA is out of this world. The game winner, it's on YouTube, against Serbia in the semi of the 2004 Olympics, is unbelievable. Everyone thought the game was finished until Manu caught it and threw it up there. He's 6'6", 205. I'm just looking at it now. 6'6", 205. He's like the perfect, you talk about the talent ID prototype. He is that guy that we spoke about last week. Could shoot the three, decision making, dexterity. He thought he was always going to go left, and he kind of always went left and still made the play. And then you just see on social media, I was on social media this week just checking it out, Robbie.
Yeah, is
and
that right?
The amount of people that have just written out to him and just said, thanks for your impact on the sport, is unbelievable. So he is, you think about him, he came off the bench and had the highest impact of his team at times, and made all-star teams off the bench, which is
shelved the ego
unheard of.
For the good of the team as well. That's the big thing there. Like, he could have commanded starting salaries at pretty much any other team he wanted of those years, and continue to come off the bench and have just a massive impact for his team.
So he was a EuroLeague Finals MVP in 2001, and if you think about Luka Doncic, who was EuroLeague MVP last year. Wouldn't it be awesome if we're talking about Luka like this on podcast number 960?
If Robbie. We're still going there, we've probably done something very, very wrong.
awesome.
It is
awesome.
An amazing career. NBL Blitz has been announced. Bendigo and Ballarat.
Well done.
In a couple of weeks' time. It's a fantastic stadium up there at Bendigo. It was up there a couple of weeks back.
Mm-hmm.
New show called looks incredible.
Awesome.
Like, just amazing.
Congrats to Vic Country for getting that done and hosting those games. That's awesome.
It'll be fantastic. Plenty it's a great opportunity to go and see good basketball. Yeah. Like, I think the league this year looks as strong as it's ever been. Some of the names that are rolling around, I think it'll be fantastic. So. No. Definitely recommend it.
A little preseason hoop for us, Robbie. Alan Houston. Do you know who Alan Houston is, Robbie?
Yeah, he's from Spain.
You're getting funny as these pods go on. But he was in Melbourne over the week.
He was good. New York Nick.
Outstanding. Talk about player development. He was in Melbourne. I think he was at VU. The court looked like VU. But he took some young fellas.
Aussie Hoopers.
Through some shooting drills yesterday, and there was a shooting drill where he literally just taught the kids to self-toss the ball out there, 2 foot stop, and shoot it one-handed. So have a look at that. That falls right into what we spoke about the last 2 weeks, but he was awesome when he was
phenomenal.
Healthy and rolling in the NBA.
He absolutely falls into my what if he didn't get injured category of players. Like, Grant Hill's in there, Tracy McGrady's in
Zeppel.
There, Zeppel is not in there. Despite what many may think, mainly Mike. Probably last of this week, Australian Rollers grabbed a bronze medal over at the IWBF Games in Hamburg.
Awesome.
It's a fantastic.
Congratulations.
Place. I think that's the fourth medal in as many tries for them. So they've done incredibly well.
Yes, yeah, so that's the world champs for the wheelchair boys. And great week for them to come away with a bronze medal. Bill Latham, 17-7-6 in the bronze medal game against Iran, which is an outstanding effort. I watched some of the under-18s wheelchair basketball that
Kevin
was on
Kearns Cup.
Down at Geelong. And unbelievable.
Yep.
Like, if you haven't watched wheelchair hoops before, have a look at it.
Yep.
These guys and girls are unbelievably skilled. The way that they can roll and stop in their chair and shoot the ball is incredible.
Yep.
So that's an awesome result for our country.
It is. And I did a clinic maybe 2 or 3 years ago. Ben Ettridge came over, who was the Rollers coach at the time, and took coaches through a clinic effectively doing what we would refer to, and I put this in quotation marks, as able-bodied drills with people in wheelchairs. And it was amazing just how much the drills are transferable. If you can coach mainstream, for lack of a better term, you will have no problems coaching athletes in wheelchairs as well.
Yep.
The skills are very transferable, the tactics and all those sorts of things. Like, there's some certain rules you need to be across, like point systems and that sort of stuff. But I would encourage anyone that's looking to get into coaching and doesn't know really where to start, jump in the wheelchair space. It's a fantastic one.
It would help your coaching tremendously. And when I was watching, like, they set flare screens the same way that the able-bodied athletes set flare screens. It's just unbelievable the way you see it unfold on the court, how they want to set up an open shot, because a lot of it is predicated on shooting an open shot. And Australian Development Camp the past couple of years has been in conjunction with the wheelchair junior athletes coming in as well, and it's been awesome just to see them on the floor.
Has been. So congratulations to the Rollers. That is it for us this week.
Well done, Robbie.
Knock that over on a very average-looking Thursday afternoon, it must be said, outside.
It's not spring. It is miserable out there.
You're heading off to your session tonight.
Workouts tonight, some play development. We'll do some stopping, some pivoting, some catching, Robbie, I promise you.
Excellent. Kids will be thrilled about
that. They already know. They already know what's coming.
Excellent. Big thanks to all our listeners as well, and everyone that reaches out during the week. Those that leave the ratings and reviews, very much appreciated. If you could go and leave one if you haven't already, only takes a little bit of time. On your end, can get the podcast, of course, on iTunes, Spotify, Audio Boom, and via the Basketball Victoria website.
Good luck with finals hoops this weekend, BJBL, Big V.
To everyone, I will give no predictions in the hope that I don't curse any of you.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks for talking split with us.